Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, October 31st. I'm Ray Graff. If the costumes and grim decorations aren't enough to scare you on this Halloween, the knowledge of our science panel surely will. It's in the script. It must be true. Barbara Brabets, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander are here. They're donning their mad scientist outfits today, and they're ready to answer your questions. The number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can email us at voxpop@wamc.org, voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number is 1-800-348-2551, the Science Forum. Scaredy boys and girls, and your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello once again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Today we reconvene the Science Forum on this Halloween as our experts are ready to respond to your terrifying questions and comments. If there are any, the number to call is 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can tweet your questions and comments at WAMC Vox Pop. You can email us if you wish at WAMC. No, it's at Vox Pop at WAMC.org. So the email address to recapitulate, voxpop@wamc.org. The number, once again, is 800-348-2551. What a great panel we have today. We got Ed Stander, Barbara Brabets, and Jimmy Pickles. They're all here to answer your questions on the Science Forum. And Barbara, that's a great outfit you got going on.
Thanks, thanks everybody. It is, after all, the day before November 1st, which means in some circles people dress up.
And you do.
Well, I don't know. Some people just said nice outfit, and I think they thought I would really wear this. So.
Well, it's becoming. What is it?
I'm dressed as Miss Frizzle from the Magic School Bus.
Magic School Bus. Good for
Students
you.
Students told me my hair went with the outfit, and so I put the outfit around the hair.
Well, that's good. Which is superb, because you'll be answering all the questions today, and we'll just sit back and listen.
Well, get on the Magic School Bus and call in. Right.
Wahoo!
Jim Pickett, we called you Pickles because your name is spelled that way on the board coming
into
the building.
And I was deeply, deeply offended.
I like it. Well, from now on, you're Jim Pickles on this program. You wanted to talk about the Nobel Award.
Yes, because in an unusual turn of events, the chemistry award was actually for chemistry.
How about that? Not for biology.
Yeah.
That's not a common thing?
No, not recently.
Okay.
Anyway, the Nobel Prize in Chemistry was for the inventions that led to the lithium-ion batteries. That everybody carries around.
But they've been in operation now in some form for years.
That's how the Nobel flies.
Really?
They
take their time?
They have to say, did this thing that happened really make an impact on society?
Yeah, because the current design was around 1991. But what this prize really showed was how difficult it is to get from first invention to something that actually works and people can buy in the marketplace. Because one of the recipients, Whittingham, was working at Exxon, which is also unusual here because two of the three awardees were working in industry at the time.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
And he really designed the first rechargeable lithium-ion battery.
Before that, there was alkaline and there was
nickel metal hydride.
Yeah.
And they had cycling issues.
The problem with his battery, though, was that after being recharged a bunch of times, little threads of lithium would go from one electrode to the other, short out the battery, and it would burst into flames.
That's not a good thing.
It is if you're cold.
So they were really required two additional inventions in order to get something that worked. And then the main inventors for those were a man named Goodenough, which I love that name.
Yeah. I love that name.
And Yoshino, who worked in industry in Japan. And that then eventually led to a battery that could be commercialized.
And what did they do? They put a little barrier between the anode and cathode?
They really had to entirely redesign the chemistry of the anode and the cathode. So it's still lithium ions going back and forth, but where they reside on each of the electrodes is very different from what it was in the original design.
Yeah.
How much money do you get for that award?
It's in euros these days, but it's a little over a million. That's not chump change.
No, yeah. We've had this conversation on the copyright forum before about intellectual property. They were working for companies at the time. Did the companies get the cash?
No, not for the award.
No?
Nope. They just got all the royalties off the patents,
yeah.
Which was well more than $1 million. Don't worry.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm not.
Yeah, Exxon,
yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah, Exxon, I think they did.
They're,
okay.
They're fine.
The number to call here is 800-348-2551. Barbara Bravitz, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander here. And Ed, your costume is good today.
Well, thank you so much.
What is it?
I've worked very hard. I'm passing off as a college professor.
Perfect.
Yeah. Who's prepping for a colonoscopy, just to give it that added twist.
Well, and therefore hasn't eaten all day, so I am ready for any questions that come my way.
Thank you all for sharing. Let's go to the phones and whoops.
So shall I just say while we click buttons that one of the professors is from Binghamton, which is a SUNY, so go SUNY. That's why I screamed
that's
go
great.
SUNY. That just wasn't an epithet in the
Hello?
Middle of the
We're
talk.
Coming, we're coming.
Well, hang on, Merle. We were just talking about SUNY. Are you there?
Okay.
Hi, Merle.
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome.
I heard the ding-dong.
Yeah, well, the ding-dong is you, so go ahead.
Oh, okay. I got a piece of, we call him Diver Dan. He's been in a rain barrel outside. He's very heavy. I'm thinking he's lead, but he's got the rust color all over him. I was going to ask, since we're talking chemistry here,
yeah,
what would mean lead or probably lead?
Hmm.
Right. He's not all lead because when lead oxidizes, it creates a gray color. And that
was the color underneath anyway.
Right. But there's
now he's orange.
If it's going in the orange, then we're definitely talking some iron here. It could be what's called pot metal, which is a mixture. It's not even really an alloy. It's just whatever's left over in the pot when you're done. So it could be a lot of different metals together. It tends to be relatively cheap and does rust, so you can get that nice patina.
Huh.
How big is Diver Dan?
He's about 2.5 inches tall.
Oh, okay.
And what was like? I can't remember what I was going to say.
What is Diver Dan? I missed this part.
He's sitting in a rain barrel outside.
What is it?
I think he's a weight for the rain barrel.
Ah.
At one time, it was for an aquarium.
Oh, okay. I gotcha. Now I understand.
Yeah, and we've had him in a rain barrel outside that's all rusty, and now he's all...
Uh-huh. So Ed has a theory now.
Is the rain barrel metal?
Yeah. My guess is if the rain barrel is rusty, that the rust is coming off the rain barrel and coating the Diver Dan.
So Diver Dan could be lead, and he's just getting coated with the rust from the barrel.
Yes, he could.
Yeah. The other thing to think about.
What would you clean it with?
A Brillo pad will work. I mean, you can just use mechanical energy to take the rust off, and then if you switch your barrel to a plastic barrel, then he won't get coated in red.
Okay.
If our theory is correct. But that's long homework. It'd take you a season to figure it out.
All right, cool, man. Thanks, Merle. We appreciate the call. 800-348-2551 is the telephone number. It's the Science Forum on WAMC. Jim Pickett, Barbara Bravitz, and Ed Stander are here. And David is in New Paltz. Hello, David.
Hello. Thanks for a great show there, Ray. My question is, how do you map the universe when everything in the universe is moving, including the observer? And where would the center of the universe be?
Okay, well, that's actually pretty easy to answer. Everything is moving, but given the scope and the size of the universe, everything is moving at a snail's pace. So, yeah, stars are moving. We're moving around the Milky Way. Everything is moving at various speeds, but the speeds are nothing compared to the distances.
Hmm.
So, for example, it takes us 70 million years, for example, to go once around the Milky Way. But the Milky Way is tiny compared to everything else. So you'd never even see that motion on a regular scale.
So does a map exist that I could inquire about?
Yeah, maps exist. And what people have done is they've taken slices out of the universe and mapped everything that's within those slices. And there are planetarium programs as well. For example, software BISC has a planetary program called SkyX, which you just keep on getting larger and larger and larger, and the stars keep on popping up.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a Oh, what is it? There's a file called UCAC, which is comes from NOAA, which has a map of every star that's presently known and constellations, etc. It takes two sides of a DVD, and there's billions of stars on it. So everything is pretty well mapped, and as I say, the motion of any of those things is extremely small compared to the distances you're talking about.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot for the call. Our number is 800-348-2551. It's the Science Forum today. We have Ed Stander, we have Jim Pickett, we have Barbara Brabets, and we'll be back. Vox Pop, the Science Forum. That's what we're doing today, and it's a fun show. 800-348-2551 if you'd like to be part of the fun today. The very fun panel we have for you. see how much fun they're having?
We're all having fun.
Just play along. Ed Stander, Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabets are here. This email came in from Tom. Tom writes, "My dreams always seem to be so imaginative and creative, but that skill seems to disappear once I'm awake." Welcome to the club, Tom. Why is our dream state so open to this kind of thinking and is missing in waking states?
I think, if I can start, I think that the problem is that while you're sleeping, there's not a lot of your brain that's looking at what you're thinking and deciding whether it's reasonable or not.
Yeah.
So you're lacking a certain amount of self-evaluation, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
So when I'm flying along on top of a cloud over Montego Bay and looking down and seeing all these wonderful people, I'm not really thinking, why the heck am I flying on this cloud up here? What's wrong with me? Because it's all part of the dream, and therefore it's all part of that virtual reality.
Yeah, I think you're right on. The edit part is quiet or quiescent, but the activity part is not, and the emotion part is not. There's an experiment, a classic experiment, done, I believe, in Europe in the 60s, where they there's a part of your brain that shuts off most body movement when you're in a dream state.
Mm.
And in animals, I think they were dog models, dogs and rabbits, they looked at prey and predators, and they disconnected that part of the brain through brain surgery. Thank God they did it then. It's not something we do now. And so that when they were dreaming, they would be acting out the activities that they were dreaming about.
In the 60s,
how could we figure out what dogs were dreaming about? And we've all seen dogs run in their sleep a little bit, or meow, cats kind of like fight in their sleep or whatever. And they found that it was activities that they most enjoy. I don't know whose opinion that was. Like, do we ask dogs if they enjoy running? But it seemed to that all of the species they did this to would do things that they enjoy. So I think the more intelligent the animal, the more varied the dreams that they had. And so there's some theory. I don't know. This is certainly, psychology is not my thing. Neuroscience isn't my thing.
Yeah.
But that the more intelligent and sentient the animal, the more complex and somewhat disturbing the dreams could be. That we would go away from the happy running dreams to kind of the, oh, God, I'm naked and I'm taking the SAT dream.
Right.
You know, that's not an...
Oh, that old dream.
That old dream.
That's right.
Yeah.
Hey, Ed, do you have a lot of dreams where you're flying over Montego Bay? Do you have a lot of flying dreams?
I have a lot of flying dreams, yeah. Mainly because I'm trying to escape from something.
Uh-oh. You think so? You think that's what it is?
Yeah. Now, I just wanted to mention on the same side that the state of dreaming is very, very similar in a lot of ways to the state of hypnosis, where you're doing exactly the same thing. You're in a dream state, effectively, and you're telling yourself that everything is fine, but you're not thinking about what you're doing. So the person tells you to do something, you wind up doing it because the self-evaluation is gone.
Who's telling you?
Well, usually the guy who's standing there and telling you to do
it. No, not in hypnosis, in the dream state.
Oh, in the dream state?
Yeah.
It's yourself. It's your self-conscious that's telling you what you want to do.
some of it is remnant memories. During the dream state, why we have to go into this dream state is really to edit short-term versus long-term memories, and there's a purge that goes on chemically. That chemical purge has to happen. If you don't go through dream state, you will lose brain function similar to what you see in Alzheimer's disease.
Huh.
You will end up with plaquing and degradation of the nervous systems without a state of sleep.
Amazing.
And dreaming. So there are some people who have a disorder where they fall asleep, but they go right into deep sleep and they don't go through that REM sleep that's necessary for the dream state. And they're as, if not more impaired than someone who did not have sleep.
I will be darned. All right, let's go back to the phones. 800-348-2551 is the number. It's the Science Forum. 1-800-348-2551. Stephen in Glens Falls. Stephen, you're on.
Hey, how are you today?
Good. How about you?
Great. So there's a postulate regarding the concept of parallel universes. Whether it holds water or not, is there any theorizing as to how windows between those parallel universes might be opened? And as an aside, with thousands of years of reports of ghosts, one wonders if, in fact, such a thing exists, parallel universes, are ghosts brief entries into our universe from another?
Hmm. Fascinating. Good timing for this call. Stephen, who wants it?
Well, there's two parts to it, I'd say. The first is, people have suggested that the energy required to produce the universe, in other words, that first Big Bang, was actually produced by a parallel universe getting in contact with our universe in a thing called a brain, B-R-A-N-E, like a membrane that touches. And as a result, that injects energy from one universe into another. That's at the beginning. And that's one of the main theories as to how the universe began.
Huh.
You can believe that.
I did not hear that one.
The other part of it is that there are four states, well, there's four dimensions that we know of, and people have argued that there are many, many other dimensions. People have suggested, for example, that light may actually go in and out of a certain one or more dimensions to reach to where we are now.
Yeah.
Things we can't explain. Even atomic tunneling could be associated with going from one dimension to another. So it doesn't necessarily have to be a parallel universe. It could just be a dimension that we just can't see.
Now, how do you test something like that, like a string theory? Is there any kind of experimentation that you can do?
That's the problem.
That really is the problem. Usually what happens is you look to see if the math works first. You take certain constraints upon your system and you set them up mathematically. And then you postulate, you put one of these theories into the mathematical sets of conditions, and you see if you get an answer that is rational. And I don't mean rational like you're not going to get carted off to the loony bin, but rather not an irrational number or a complex number that you're not going to get like, sorry, doesn't compute. That's really some of the first steps to designing these. But they're only as good as what your parameters are, and we can only imagine what those parameters would be.
And just like curve fitting, if you keep on putting enough statements in a curve fit, you'll fit the data perfectly, even though there's really no relationship. So what happens is if it doesn't work the first time, add more to it, and that's how we come up with 11, 12, 13 dimensions.
Yeah, and string theory.
And then that also makes the theory less satisfying. One of the things which to me kind of makes this interaction between parallel universes less likely is that if it happened, then fundamental laws of physics like conservation of energy and such wouldn't be valid, because if things pass from one universe to another, mass and energy would not be conserved. And that's never been observed.
Except that then you have a scale factor, that we're talking about the Earth and we're looking at things going on the Earth. And sure enough, conservation of energy, mass, and even the conservation of fat works here.
Yeah.
But if you take it on a larger scale, then you really don't know what's going on once you get outside of your own little world.
Isn't that what quantum is all about? Things act more, they act differently on a very, very, very small scale?
Yeah, we understand, we can we have a set of conditions for the very, very large, gravity being one of the central concepts of that. And then we have a growing set of conditions for how things act when either they're massless, like light, which we assume is massless, but there's more evidence that maybe it's not, or just very, very light, like electrons, so how electrons behave. And they behave weirdly. They do not behave in the classical sense. So the two sets of conditions are almost mutually exclusive. One doesn't seem like, on a teeter-totter in the classical world, one side goes up, the other side goes down. In the quantum world, one side goes up, the other side, who knows where the heck it is and what it's doing. So it's really bizarre.
And when you get even larger, when you start talking about universes, anything is possible. For example, there's a thing called dark energy, which says that over time, the universe has expanded and contracted in order to make up for the change that we're seeing in light. And it's very possible that the universe may not have expanded and contracted. That just fits our model. It may just be that, for example, light is slowing down and speeding up on a very large scale. So, you know, everything's in the open if you want it to be. Which makes it very difficult.
Yeah, it sure does. But it makes for another 27 minutes of a program. So well done. 800-348-2551.
Let's solve it.
Barbara Pravitz, Jim Pickett, and Ed Stander here today on the Science Forum. Matt in Saratoga Springs. Hello, Matt.
Hey, good afternoon. Happy Halloween.
And to you.
I had a quick question on around climate change. Is the group aware of any investment from governments to create, you know, some type of machine that can help pull carbon out of the air, similar to the process of photosynthesis? And if yes, how effective are those efforts right now?
Yeah, there are efforts to do that. There are ways that it can be done. It's a matter of doing it economically and at scale.
And that the energy put in to create the machine to pull energy out isn't a zero-sum game.
Yeah.
Right, you don't want to have to spend that much energy to take energy out.
Which is why people use algae, for example, to do the job, because algae is there and doesn't cost anything to produce.
Yeah, and if you're going to capture carbon dioxide, it would be easier to capture it at a point source like a coal plant, and even that hasn't been demonstrated to really work economically.
One of the cheaper ways to do it, although I'm not advocating this, is to take your carbon and inject it into the groundwater. Mm-hmm. If you take your CO2 and you inject it into the groundwater, it does not release quickly to the atmosphere. But what it does do is it changes the acidity or basicity of the water, and therefore, if your groundwater becomes more acidic, it can start solubilizing, dissolving the metals that are in your groundwater. If it's a little bit of magnesium or calcium, you have hard water, it's not that big of a deal. But if you have granite bedrock, for example, you get uranium.
Right.
You can get nonmetals like fluoride, which can be dangerous in high levels. So there are consequences that can be predicted from doing this, but this is a relatively straightforward and quote-unquote cheap, financially cheap way to get rid of carbon.
Hmm. Yeah,
I think it can be injected very deep.
Very deep.
Into basalt deposits.
Yeah, but water always moves. It's just a scale. Just like all the scale stuff we've talked about today, we're talking like 30,000 years of movement instead of like 3 years worth of movement.
And of course, the Earth does it itself anyway. It produces hydrothermal liquids all the time, and they are very high in heavy metals and everything else. So what we'd be doing effectively is trying to do what nature does, but on a much smaller scale.
It's the Science Forum on WAMC. 800-348-2551 is the number. John and Kanan. John, you're on.
Well, I hope this is a very simple question for you guys. It's not been simple for me to understand the nature of this entity called space-time. It's something that we've been taught to think about for quite a few years now. And I understand the other three dimensions and what they amount to. But I have great trouble understanding the relationship between space and time that causes us to now need to think of it as one single entity. I wondered if you could explain that interrelationship.
I think that'll take the rest of the show up. All right,
simple, simple question.
Yeah. Go ahead. And don't use your hands.
Don't use my hands. I'm just a simple organic chemist, so this is way out of my pay grade. But it's a matter that around massive objects, and becomes important around only really, really big things like the sun or black hole and stuff. what you think ought to be a straight line isn't. It curves in toward the mass of object. And it's really something that you can't visualize in three dimensions plus one, because you just, our brain
you
doesn't.
You can put a bowling ball on a bed,
yeah,
and that's the old.
The thing to do is to reduce it down from three dimensions to two dimensions.
Yep.
So now you've got something that you can describe as distortions in that surface, but caused by the heavy object. Where time comes in is that time.
I understand the. All right, go ahead. Yeah. I'm sorry.
You understand the curvature of space then by gravity, John?
Yeah, I understand the bowling ball and the going around the planet, and it is a straight line, but it should be a straight line, but it isn't. But I don't see how that helps answer the question.
Yeah, well, I think time does the same thing. The strong gravitational fields bend time. Change time in this similar way as they bend space, and in fact, at the cosmic scales, time becomes just another dimension in dealing with all of this. It is not something that we mere mortals can get our heads around very well. It exists mostly in the mathematics. And that's about as deep as my understanding of that can go.
I appreciate what I recommend.
We've got a try number two on the table here.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Okay. My try is this: in the past, we had space and we had time, and they were two separate things, and that worked fine on a certain scale, but the problem is that you take something like light, and you shoot a light beam from here to the moon. And it is, oh my gosh.
1.3 seconds.
Yeah. Okay, look, why don't we just take it for homework?
So you're going to figure out space time for homework?
I'm going to figure out a way to explain space time in 3 minutes.
That's terrific.
What I recommend is that anything that I happen to know about space time comes from YouTube videos.
Wow.
And there is, in fact, a YouTube channel called Space Time.
Wow.
Part of the PBS video series, and I highly recommend that one. There are a gazillion on there. You go through and find the titles that you like, and this guy explains.
All right, I tell you what, John, that's your homework. Then you check that out, and then Ed is going to figure out space time, and then maybe you call us back on the next show.
Understand that if you start watching YouTube videos, there's a very good chance you'll be outside of space-time.
All right, John, thanks a lot for the call. Hey, let's take a break, Zach the engineer. 800-348-2551 is our number. Science Forum today, light topics. Barbara Brabitz, Jim Pickles, Ed Stander here. We'll be back. Vox Pop, the Science Forum. Ray Graff with you at 800-348-2551. And Jim Pickett, Barbara Brabitz, and Ed Stander here. You know, this is from Ian in Saugerties. Just came in via email. And I want to thank Ian for reminding me of this. We touched on quantum mechanics a moment ago, and then I thought briefly about that quantum computer that we heard about a few weeks ago. And Ian's question, how do you think of a computation that would take today's best computer 10,000 years to solve? How do you even comprehend that? And that's the first question of three. Now, if you know this quantum computer news, it allegedly solved in 300 seconds or something, this 10,000-year problem using the quantum drive, whatever that is.
So we have lots of science problems where we have multiple conditions, environmental conditions, that we have to consider at the same time. And I think of it like a really complex Sudoku, where if I move one letter or one of those little, maybe not a Sudoku, but one of those word slide games where you have to, like a Rubik's Cube, move stuff around, but the others move when you move the one.
Right.
And when you have tens of thousands of conditions that all change when you move one dot on the one condition, the other 9,999 change.
Yeah.
So a quantum computer allows you to test all of those conditions at the same time, all of them being perturbed, as we call it in the biz, where we change each one and we look at the effects that they have on all of them.
Mm-hmm.
In our linear computer systems, we change one, we wait for all the others to kind of catch up, and then we see where we are, and then we do it again, and then we see where we are. And that's slow. It's kind of the serial idea of re-querying, re-asking the computer to do the same thing each time, catching up to what the new situation is. That's what quantum computers will be able to do fast.
Ian, second question. Do you know what the equation was about?
Oh, my gosh. I don't think any of us do.
Not a clue.
I don't think it's out yet.
Third question. And if this computer figured it out in 200 seconds, does that mean that this is now many hundred million years more advanced now than when they plugged it in? And who can unplug
100
it?
100 million years? We've only been around for 170,000 years. So are there pre-human computers? I don't know. I would say you cannot be sure that the answer that they got in 300 seconds is correct.
Is correct, right. Who's checking the work?
42.
That was the answer.
It's the ultimate answer.
That's right.
So you can't just say, we got an answer. We're going to run. How do you know it did it right?
Okay. Got to make another computer.
You do.
Even stronger than the first computer.
And then see if it comes up with the same answer.
This is from Tim in Steventown. Can you explain the north-south shift in the orbit of the moon and how it relates to the ecliptic and the celestial equator?
Well, thanks a lot, guys.
Hey, I
Everyone
think quantum
looks to
computing.
Ed.
Come yeah. on.
The moon is not on the equator of the Earth. Almost every moon in the entire solar system is on the equator of the planet.
Right.
The moon is actually 12 degrees off. So the tilt of the Earth is 23.5 degrees. 12 degrees of that's where the moon is, and then you've got the equator. Now, that's the geometry of it. Now, what was the question?
Oh, my God. Really? Okay. Let me get it out of the recycle bin. Here we go. Can you explain the north-south shift in the orbit of the moon and how it relates to the ecliptic and the celestial equator?
Is this a test question that someone's doing at home?
Okay, so it's going to be then close to the ecliptic, but could then go above it and below it as...
Well, it's going to do that anyway because it's tilted, and sometimes it'll pass through the equator, and sometimes it doesn't.
Yep.
When it passes through the equator, we have an eclipse. But I don't know about the north-south shift of it.
Well, Tim? Why don't you hang out on that one, and when astronomer Bob Berman is here, you can repose that question. Let's now go back to the phones at 800-348-2551. John in Pinebush. John, you're on.
Hey, good afternoon, everybody. I wanted to ask something kind of spooky because it's Halloween.
Yeah.
And it has to do with UFOs. I figured that would be spooky enough.
Okay.
It has to do with a group called the Academy, To the Stars Academy.
Oh, yeah.
And the video, everybody's aware of the videos that were released by the Navy.
Yep.
And about a month ago, the Pentagon actually confirmed that the videos were real.
That
so
is
now,
correct.
Scientists are like scratching their heads, like, what the heck are they? But what is really interesting is last week they announced a joint research project with the Army to analyze the metamaterials that were residue from either crash sites or somehow related to UFOs.
Yeah.
So they're going to be analyzing these metamaterials. And I didn't know if any of your guests might be aware of that.
I'm aware of it.
All kinds of very, very unusual properties.
There are a number of things to unpack with that one. Number one, why is the Army getting involved with this group? But number two, let's ask the science panel, what are metamaterials?
Well, the word is just used as really a phrase to mean everything. Meta means together or all. So we're talking about whatever's left over in the residue. So I've heard metamaterials used, for example, with meteorites before. You know, your meteorite crashes, you've got foreign substance that's coming down, hitting the ground, it's going to change and transform the properties of the soil in the area that it hits as well. So you've got original material, plus you've got the material from the high impact zone. I haven't heard metamaterials. I haven't heard this particular digest of studying metamaterials by... The skeptic in me says, why would they announce it?
Well, yes.
And why wouldn't they have just done that to begin with?
There are a number of questions along those lines.
Right. So yes. I'm always going to scratch my head. I've seen the videos, too, and it's obvious that whatever propulsion, if that video is real, and there's a big if, whatever means of propulsion that object goes through is not a traditional means. That's all. Hmm. That doesn't necessarily mean it's not man-made. You don't think some other...
Presumably unmanned, however, as the G's would certainly tear somebody to shreds.
Well, we have... Imagine if we took a drone from our fleet right now and brought it back to the 1960s and flew it over an aircraft carrier. I'm not saying this is time travel, folks. I'm just saying if, you know, an unmanned drone in 1960 is pretty outrageous of what it would be able to do, and they'd say, well, how did they get a person in that, right?
But, so, but it's quite a leap from...
It's a big leap.
Well,
the propulsion.
It's a leap from the signals that are being seen, the detection, and saying that it relates to a thing.
Well, there is, in fact, some fairly good video that was released.
Well, even
that
even,
looks like a thing. It does. It is not a radar blip.
The range of strange optical phenomena is just staggering.
Ed's been awfully quiet.
And you're seeing
an optical artifact. It's actually was tracked by the gunship radar, and there was one video where the object actually submerged and then came out of the water and didn't lose any speed.
But we have the technology ourselves out in the open to not make a radar blip. Right, we have the technology to do so. If you were creating, say you're just a Homo sapien on this planet and you're Dr. Evil and you're going to make one of these things, wouldn't you make it radar invisible to begin with? Why would you make it? Why would you show this thing off as much as you have when you have the capability of making it radar invisible?
The question is, if you're advanced enough to make that kind of thing, radar wouldn't be a concern.
I think all of these questions, these proposing motives, it's jumping the gun, and it's inherently not the way to go here. Ed, have you seen the video?
I haven't seen the video, no.
You have not seen this?
Mm-hmm. I have seen meteorites that come in at 400,000 miles an hour, though.
They don't change direction and stop in the middle of the sky.
No, they don't. Yeah. Hey, John, I'm following this one. We'll keep an eye on it.
Excellent. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. 800-348-2551. It is a fascinating bunch of videos. My first skeptical question is, why were they released?
And, who's showing off?
And to what end? Mm-hmm. And the whole thing is just a little odd. Kristen in New Paltz. Kristen, you're on.
Hi there. I'm just wondering where all of the layers that cover up archaeological digs, I mean, they're tens or hundreds of feet down under the earth. Does all the stuff that's covering those sites up come from? Are mountains getting smaller?
Well, if you're talking about archaeological digs, generally speaking, prehistoric people lived by the sides of rivers, and rivers flood. And over time, they will produce a huge amount of material that'll effectively bury everything. Now, if you're talking about older things, dinosaurs and such, that's a whole other story, because then you have oceans that can actually cover the land for hundreds of millions of years and layer huge amounts of sedimentary material on top of things. So both are possible. It all depends on what your time scale is.
We could still wind weather as well. I mean, there is weathering from wind as well. And so you can have deposits of sand, but water is a big force, yep. And of course, if we had dinosaurs above the ground, they would have been weathered away, and we don't find them, right? You're only going to find them below our feet, never above our feet.
How much stuff comes from space every year, mass-wise?
It's like 100 pounds of water a year from comets.
Yeah, about 11,000 tons of material from meteorites.
Yeah.
So over a billion years or 60 million years since the dinosaurs are here, that's a lot.
Yeah, but just shake the snow globe up every couple hundred million years. I mean, that's all we're doing, really. We're just moving stuff around.
Yeah. All right, Kristen, thanks a lot. 800-348-2551 is the number to call. And Jeffrey in Hebron. Jeffrey, you're on.
Hi. I just have kind of a crazy question. I've been listening to the program. You're talking about dreams and other things. Years ago, Mount Pinatubo blew up, and we had a very severe winter following that, and just following global warming. I had a crazy dream about how scientists were able to start blowing up, using nuclear devices, selected volcanoes to be able to have eruptions, to be able to cool off the planet to, at least in the short term, combat global warming. So I just wanted to throw that dream out at you. And then wish you a happy Halloween.
Yeah. Thank you. That, in fact, is a serious, not blowing up volcanoes with nuclear bombs, but putting stuff into the atmosphere to create aerosols that will reflect sunlight is a serious
proposition. They call that the nuclear winter, right?
Well, yeah, if you did it by blowing up volcanoes.
Right, but you could do it with, like, silver chloride. Or...
Well, no, but
you... Are you talking about chemtrails?
No.
Are you talking about chemtrails?
Would you stop?
All right, I know. No. I'm not supposed to say that on the science forum.
We're talking about injecting sulfur dioxide or other materials into the stratosphere. And it's a potentially practical thing to do.
Yeah.
It's just that you're just messing with the controls of the entire world. Yeah. And are we sure enough about what we're doing to want to...
Yeah, because that stopped us before.
Twisting the knobs.
Yeah, basically, the answer is if you start taking care of the weather, then you're going to spend the rest of your life taking care of the weather.
Yeah. You know what? I got to say, the reaction on everybody's face when I said chemtrails was that was truly...
It was
you were terrified.
Trick or treat.
Chemtrails.
Yeah.
Look at them. Oh, they jump away. All right, Tom and Gilderland. Tom.
Happy Halloween.
Hello. Yes. If the universe is expanding, what does it expand into?
That is such a great question. And boy, I wish I had the answer to that.
I wish I owned that real estate. You know?
I can tell you one thing about the universe expansion, which has to be considered. Is that when anything expands, normally it gets colder and it becomes less dense. And what we have been finding out from all our research is that as this universe has been expanding, it has not been getting colder and it has not been becoming less dense.
Is the density staying the same?
The density is staying almost exactly the same, which means that the universe is probably expanding into a universe that's already there.
Huh.
And so we are effectively taking material from a previous universe and embodying it in our own universe today. That's the only explanation that I've been able to come up with to explain that fact.
But we don't know the means by which the energy or matter transfer is taking place.
Well, we do actually to some extent. If you take a metal with a whole bunch of crystals in it and you heat that metal, for example, then the grain boundaries will start to move. The size of the slide or the size of the material won't change, but each of the pieces of it will become larger or smaller depending on the geometry. And you can have the same thing occurring, for example, where you have effectively material moving into our universe from our universe as it expands into it.
So other universes have to disappear or diminish.
Somebody else has to get smaller.
Well, it becomes incorporated.
Yeah.
All right, Tom, thank you for that one. Over to Nick in Albany. Nick, you're on.
Hi, yeah, I had a question. I went to an Asian restaurant recently, and I had a steamed egg. And I tried to recreate this at home, and I forgot to add salt. And when I made it again, I added the salt, and I noticed there was a huge difference in the texture and the kind of the binding ability of the egg. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could maybe shed what is the salt actually doing here while it's being cooked?
Hmm. The salt is, well, I'll start it. The salt is effectively taking the water out of the egg because the salt is drawing the water out of the structure, and as a result, it's becoming tougher and tougher. That's what a 1,000-year-old egg is when they talk about those. They're taking eggs and they're putting them in a bath of salt, effectively, and allowing the salt to take it out over a period of time. Not 1,000 years, but basically that's the idea.
Hmm.
The other thing that the salt does is it gives, at the molecular level, it gives the proteins that are in the egg white mm-hmm. A predictable means by which to screw up. So we denature that protein in that process of steaming the egg. We do so both thermally, you know, with the heat, and we also do so with the salt. Those are two different means by which you can, there are two of five different means that, by which you can poison, disassemble the protein. And if you can disassemble it in a repeating and regular pattern, then the texture will reflect that. Mm-hmm. So think of like a whipped egg white. The whipping and the shearing force that you put into the egg white changes the texture of the egg white, even though it's exactly the same protein that's inside that steamed egg.
Okay. Well, that was a good one, Nick. Thanks a lot for the call. Let's go to Great Barrington and Bill. Bill, you're on.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes. Can you hear us?
Hello.
Hello.
Yes, I can. I'm always worried about... Hi. Can you hear me?
Hello. Yes. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, I can.
All
okay.
Right.
Back in the day when I was a kid, we used to sit around as kids do and think up impossible and weird stuff. And one of the things we always agreed upon was that the concept that light is an illusion caused by too much heat. And I'd like to know what your panel thinks of that hippy-dippy concept.
All right, let's switch on the lava lamp, kids, and we have a minute and a half. Go ahead.
Okay, there are several ways that light can be created, but it all involves electrons dropping from an excited high energy state to a lower energy state, and that gives out a chunk of light. And all light that you see is originally generated in that sort of way, whether it's light from the sun or light from your LED.
So if you go back to the too much heat part,
yeah. Now, one of the ways to generate light is by heating something up like a light bulb filament until it's white hot. But that's still giving off those bits of light by that same way. There's excited electrons that are dropping down and giving off the light.
Okay.
So heat can produce light, but it all comes from the electrons in the atoms.
And it should be mentioned as well.
Without that ability of without the heat, in other words, to excite the electrons, in our natural world at least, rather than the world of the laboratory, light is indeed an illusion caused by, like our sun.
No, it's not an illusion at all.
I can take two atoms and collide them together, no heat, almost no heat, and I can still get that same effect because there's other types of energy besides heat. We have energy of motion. We have energy that's chemical energy of bonds that have energy within them that we can then harness. So it's not necessarily all heat.
Yeah, glow sticks are strictly chemical. The LED lighting is from electrons dropping into holes in the semiconductor. So you don't need heat to make light. And by no means is it an illusion. Light is a real thing.
Well, everybody, we dropped the bowling ball on the bed, and the space-time continuum is now taking us to the end of the program. Support comes from Paul Smith's College, students pursuing degrees in environmental studies, recreation, science, forestry, management, and more. Hands-on education at the college's 14,000-acre lakeside campus, paulsmiths.edu. The Albany Pinebush Discovery Center, presenting October programs featuring a variety of guided autumn season and fall foliage walks, albanypinebush.org. At Interim Healthcare, helping people remain at home for 50 years, providing companions, aides, and nurses in the home 2 to 24 hours a day, serving the Capital Region, Columbia County, Glens Falls, and Saratoga, interimhealthcare.com. Well, thanks again to Barbara Brabitz, Ed Stander, and Jim Pickett for being here today. Thank you for listening. Really weird calls at times. Good show. Always enjoy that, especially on Halloween. Zach Malloy, who's, my God, that costume was terrifying, Zach. Don't ever wear that again. Kayleen White took the calls. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we welcome the chefs of Terrapin Restaurant, The Roundhouse at Butterfield. They'll be taking part in Hudson Valley Restaurant Week. Right now, though, stand by for the Capital Connection.